Welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast. My name's Phil Topham, Executive Director of the FIEC, and with me for In the News, our regular look at the news of the week, is our National Director, John Stevens. Hello, John.
Phil.
And Adrian Reynolds, our Head of National Ministries. Hello, Adrian.
Now,
we are not in the studio this week. We're out and about, and there's a reason for this, because you're all heading off in different directions. Adrian, Where are you going from here?
I'm going to Keswick.
What are you doing?
Where I am helping to run a training. It's not a weekend because it runs Thursday to Saturday, but a training 48 hours for leaders, lay leaders, elders in church. Looking forward to that.
Very good. And John?
I'm going to King's Park Conference Centre in Northampton for the Affinity Theological Studies Conference. This is a kind of biannual event. It's kind of 3 days, opportunity to gather together and think about a key issue. This time we're thinking about firm foundation priorities for the rising generation.
What does that mean?
You need biennial, not biannual.
I mean biannual, yes. Every couple of years. Yeah. I mean, it's thinking about how we reach the next generation and engage them with the gospel. Okay. So there's a sort of a series of really great papers on that. We'll be discussing and thinking through how we can meet the challenge.
Fantastic. You're off to Wembley.
It's not
Papa John's trophy.
Be quite a leading, wouldn't it?
Pizza
if I was disappearing. Well, exactly, if I was disappearing there now. Not quite yet. Anyway, before we get to all that, let's talk about the news this week, some of the things that have been going on. And let's start with something that's been announced by Suella Braverman, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak as well, getting behind this, which is the plan for stopping small boats coming across the channel, bringing asylum seekers, refugees to British shores. So Suella Braverman stood up to say enough is enough, and basically banning people who are illegal immigrants from claiming asylum in Britain. What do we make of this? It's had huge amount of reaction, perhaps most tellingly in this first phase of reaction from Gary Lineker, the Match of the Day presenter, basically comparing it to...
Friend of the show, is he?
basically comparing it to 1930s Germany. Strong words. A reaction of some of the pastors I've seen on social media, not very happy about this direction. How do we respond to it, first of all?
Well, it seems to me government is attempting to deal with a really, really difficult issue and a really intractable issue. I mean, as Christians, the Bible tells lots of stories of kind of refugees, those who fled kind of persecution. God's people have regularly been in the situation of being refugees, strangers and aliens. Biblically, we have a real concern for the foreigner and the stranger. We ought to have a real empathy with those who are the victims of persecution, oppression, and poverty. But at the same time, what the government is trying to deal with is an intractable problem of kind of illegal entrance into the country. There's no doubt that there is a very significant public feeling against those who illegally seek to enter the UK. And if the government is taken at its word, what they're trying to do is address the problem of illegal asylum seekers. So there's actually a high level of migration to the UK. I think net migration last year was over 500,000. So there is significant migration, large numbers.
And not all on boats.
Not all on boats.
Well, that is very visible, but actually it's
boats are 40 to 80,000. Yeah. So the majority are not on boats. And actually, the UK has welcomed a very large number of people from, for example, Afghanistan, Hong Kong in the last year. I think I read it was about 143,000 have come from Hong Kong legally. Whereas those coming on boats are those who are entering the UK illegally and seeking asylum. They may well be fleeing persecution or poverty, but actually they're entering the UK in an illegal sort of way. They've come through other safe countries that they could have claimed asylum in but didn't. Many are young men who have clearly paid to be transported to the UK. So there's a kind of a whole criminal business of kind of providing people with routes to enter into the UK. So the government has said what they want to do is deal with the illegal routes into the UK so that people can only come and claim asylum through legitimate and legal routes. And I think for a lot of people, they will empathise with that. That there is a feeling against those who they feel are cheating the system by entering illegally. And actually, history shows that once people get here, it's very difficult for them to be sort of removed, sent back elsewhere. Their asylum claims may well be upheld as sort of valid. And because they've arrived, they have the right to stay.
I think the number of people who make asylum claims when they're here and are granted asylum is very, very
absolutely
high.
Yeah.
It's 90%, yeah. I think, kind of.
So the thing I don't understand is, if you come here, you can claim asylum, yeah, can't you? Isn't that the law? So I can't. So I don't quite understand what they're trying to achieve.
Well, the government's point is they should claim asylum somewhere else, not come here. And by cutting off illegal entrance into the UK, I think their hope is they will be destroying the business model of the people traffickers who are bringing them to the UK. So I think at one level, we can have empathy with that. I think some of the criticisms that have been made, which are legitimate and right, is this really going to work? So it's all very well speaking tough, stop the boats, kind of send people back to sort of either where they've come from or to other third party safe countries. So the government is saying it's not that we're going to prevent people having asylum and safety. It's just not going to be in the UK. It's going to be in other safe places. Of course, the challenge and the problem is whether they'll really be able to do that. And that's not just a matter of European Convention of Human Rights and the various refugee conventions. In many of the cases of those who come, if you don't know which country they've come from or a country won't accept them back again, will there really be somewhere else to send them? So I think one of the great fears is that you have this strict policy that arrests people, detains people, says they've got to be returned as quickly as possible. But the real challenge is having places to return them to. So I think there are questions of whether it's workable. There are some questions of whether it's legal under European conventions. That seems to be debated and that will no doubt be considered. I think the other element is whether government has genuinely provided legal routes for people to seek entry into the UK. So at one level, it's predicated on there being fair legal routes to be able to obtain kind of asylum. And I think one of the questions is that really the case? It's been pointed out, for example, if you're a 16-year-old male orphan in Africa who is fleeing persecution and you have relatives in the UK, is there a channel by which you could actually legally claim asylum in the UK? So I think the government is trying to deal with an intractable problem. And I think some of the criticism is this really workable? And are we providing fair routes to seek legal immigration? But I think some of the language of hostility has been overblown. Mm. So I think Gary Lineker's comment about this as being like Germany in the 1930s, I think that rhetoric, and on both sides of this debate, you have a really unhelpful rhetoric, both about those who are seeking asylum and about kind of government policy that doesn't reflect the attempt to try to resolve a really significant kind of issue.
Adrian, how do church leaders navigate it with their congregation?
It's a really good question. And I think one of the things we've got to remember is there are elements of this that are about compassion and kindness, but at heart, it is a political question. So quite how we deal with migration, what our view on migration is, and how we relate that to the work of the church. I think we've got to be aware we are veering heavily into politics. Mm. And it's not wrong, of course, for either for leaders or for Christians or for churches to have a view on that. But it's not just about, well, if you're compassionate, you'll make this decision. If you're not, you'll make that decision. They are basically political questions that are being decided. And of course, they have ramifications because they are, you know, talking about individuals here. Mustn't forget we're talking about individuals, someone who's finding life very difficult, wants to come to the UK for whatever reason. That person is a real person made in the image of God. We want to have compassion and kindness at that point. But actually, the solutions we're talking about are political solutions. We've got to remember that Rishi Sunak has made this one of his five mission priorities on which the government will be evaluated and either have been seen to have been successful or not. So stop the boats is number five. It seems to me it's quite a pejorative statement, but it has three words, which is the in thing these days. So stop the boats is the answer. And I think we've got to be careful. For example, as we lead our church in prayer on Sunday, we want to show compassion to those who are marginalised and persecuted. We want to be welcoming, as indeed the UK has been welcoming for a very long time in broad terms. But we also want to remember that the solutions are political. So there are people in the church who might share our compassion, but not our political convictions about whether this is the right way to do it or not. So just because someone comes to a different political conclusion doesn't necessarily mean that they lack compassion or lack kindness. And I think we've got to be very careful about conflating these issues into just one big issue. Well, as a Christian, you must think this. I think it's more complex than that. And therefore, an element of sensitivity is important. And of course, at a micro level, we welcome everybody who walks in the doors of church. So however they've come, we want to show kindness and compassion to people who walk in the door. And a lot of churches are wrestling with this. What do we do when an illegal immigrant comes to church? What do we do about that? And individual churches, again, probably come to different conclusions about that. But actually, at that point, it is about the individual and how you show kindness and compassion. But I do think we need to remember it is a political issue. Mm. And just as if, you know, you were talking about, I don't know, educational policy, you might be careful about how you do that in church on Sunday. I think an element of care is also required on this.
Mm. That's right. I think we need to recognise it's an incredibly complex problem to which there are not easy solutions. And I think often in the church, we like to think we know what the answer might be and we have a view. And you know, we're not fully aware of all of the complexities and the realities of what that might be. And I entirely agree with Adrian. Actually, the other question is actually as churches, we need to be welcoming and caring for the asylum seekers who have arrived. At one level, that once people have got here, and are permitted to stay, and the vast majority who stay, they need to be welcomed, they need to be cared for, they need to be accepted. And churches have been remarkable at welcoming asylum seekers in a way, no matter how they've got here. So churches have been at the forefront of welcoming asylum seekers from, or people coming from Hong Kong. The church has been remarkable in its response to the kind of Ukrainian refugees who've come. So we need to differentiate kind of caring for individuals who are in front of us with the kind of bigger public policy.
And also seeing remarkably evangelistic fruit work amongst asylum seekers, and especially amongst an Iranian diaspora, but not only. And the reality is actually an Afghani person is more likely to hear the gospel coming here as an asylum seeker than they are in Afghanistan. And actually, there are great opportunities. And there are great stories like at Bethlehem Oldham and other places. You can look at Steve Neal's blog and see some of that. And there are lots of other churches as well, where churches are working hard to welcome people from other cultures and nationalities as asylum seekers. There's a cost to that. You know, walking with someone through a process, for example, you know, it's costly, but actually it is fruitful as well.
I think we can also, from our perspective of our vision for global mission and the world, we need to be concerned for the countries that people are coming from. It reminds us that people are fleeing either from great economic deprivation, which reminds us of how wealthy and privileged we are, but we ought to be concerned for parts of the world in which people's lives is so miserable, so economically disadvantaged, or places of extreme violence, or places of religious persecution. Many of those who are fleeing because of potentially religious persecution, because of their faith and where they are. And we ought to be praying for those countries. We ought to be concerned for those countries. We ought to be lobbying our government to take action. So the government has said it's got a commitment to wanting to prevent religious discrimination around the world. We want to keep reminding them of that. I mean, at the same time that the government is dealing with illegal immigration, it's also cutting its government kind of sort of aid to kind of developing countries. Again, that aid, which helps countries to be able to develop, to overcome poverty, is another way in which, in the long run, kind of migration is reduced because people are happy to remain, to stay in their own countries, which are stable, peaceful, free, and where they have economic opportunities. So there's not just dealing with the immediate issue, there's the much bigger question of what are the causes that make people want to come to the West, come to Britain. And we ought to be concerned about that.
So that's one political story. Another big political story.
Another one? Week.
Oh, please. Well, yeah. Please. So the journalist Isabel Oakeshott, who ghostwrote Matt Hancock's book about the COVID pandemic, has released into the public domain via a series of serials in The Telegraph, 100,000 WhatsApp messages from central government that was made available to her as part of ghostwriting Matt Hancock's book. So there's been a series of kind of revelations through The Telegraph, which has been picked up by the other media this week. Where do we start with this?
Can I just say, by the way, that some of them are very banal, and reading 100,000 of them, goodness me.
Well, let's start with the principle, first of all, of this coming into the public domain. There's going to be a public inquiry. Is it right that these were leaked? Was there, as Isabel Oakeshott says, a huge public interest defence in releasing these at this point?
Can I just go back one stage?
Yeah.
I think I've only read bits of Matt Hancock's book. It is an extraordinary exercise in self-justification. So I think even before you get to the leaks, there is a question about whether politicians should be self-justifying in that way and having to present themselves as something perhaps even better than they are. Mm. I think there is a lesson there for leaders. That there is always a temptation to be very defensive about our leadership style, content, decisions, and to want to be self-justifying all the time. I don't think many pastors are writing ghost-written autobiographies.
Not that I'm aware of. I think that's probably right, yeah.
But that desire in the human heart to self-justify is very deep. Mm. So actually, even before you get to the leak and whether that was right or not, that the original intention of giving her all the messages so that you can write a book that basically self-justifies, I think is shows you something of the human condition. And we've got to guard against that.
And I think in both respects, both Matt Hancock's book and what Isabel Oakeshott has done, both in some ways have the potential to subvert the public inquiry. As sort of Hancock's book was a kind of a self-justification, Isabel Oakeshott is not a neutral observer on this. Yeah. She has revealed these documents because she takes a particular view that's anti-lockdown, that's libertarian. She wishes this material to be used to kind of make that case ahead of the public inquiry. And at one level, actually the public inquiry is meant to be weighing all of this in the round, sort of in a sense judging how the government responded holistically to what was a very significant health challenge that presented itself. So I think actually both parties in this case have wanted to get their stories out because there's a particular agenda behind that. I hope the public inquiry will be able to assess this more kind of objectively and make more objective judgments about whether or not policy decisions that were made were a kind of appropriate, wrong, understandable, were they mendacious or not? That's the task of a public inquiry. And one feels that in both cases, there's to some degree, a desire to kind of subvert that process.
There's an element of hindsight with all this as well, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've been talking about this amongst ourselves, that it's very easy to say what is the right or wrong thing to do with all the information we have now. But they didn't have all the information then, and they were dealing with a completely unprecedented case. You know, I think if there was another outbreak now, you would hope that people would respond in a slightly different way with more, just with more information to base their decisions on. But actually, they weren't sure what things were going to happen as a result, and they weren't sure how people were going to respond to laws. And so actually reading today's information back into that context is very dangerous, I think, very unhelpful. I think there's another point, though, about this, Phil, which is the texts do reveal at a certain level of duplicitousness about leadership. They're saying one thing in private and another thing in public. And in particular, they're being very rude about people in private. Mm.
Teachers, for example.
Yeah, but also one another. Mm. And I would hope that as Christian leaders, we would have a better sense of and desire to pursue integrity. And actually, we have an elders WhatsApp group at our church. I guess lots of churches would have something like that where they communicate with one another. A good question to ask is, what would happen if all of these were made public? Mm. And in fact, if we're saying things about people in private that we're not willing to say in public, there are deep questions to be asked. Mm. So if we're saying to one another on the WhatsApp group, oh, so-and-so is such an awkward, this or that, I wish they were somewhere else, or if only they were another, that sort of thing, I think, should be ringing alarm bells.
Yeah.
And I worry that the instant messaging kind of social media world that exists in private through WhatsApp groups, WhatsApp groups especially, I think, are pernicious for this, does actually bring out the worst in us. I think we've always got to be asking questions about how we talk to one another. You know, if it's interesting, at our church, we have someone who's not an elder at our elders' meetings taking minutes. I think that's quite healthy in some ways. Actually, there's a guard. You know that information is recorded accurately and objectively. But I think we've got to be careful that we're not saying things in private that we wouldn't be prepared to say in public.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because what WhatsApp has done is it's basically formalised what you might call water cooler conversations, which for Christian leaders should always still be godly conversations. But they're now happening in this kind of text message format, of which there
and there's great value to that.
Right? Yes.
Because actually, elders can't gather around the water cooler every minute. So actually, to be able to just fire off at WhatsApp message and get some response, I think that's really healthy at some levels. We don't want to denigrate that, but we do need to be thinking, this information could be public, and we ought not to be saying things in private. We're not prepared other people to see.
Mm. Interestingly, the Bible does tell us that every word will be ultimately brought into judgment. Yeah. There is no secret, hidden privacy from God. God knows the words that we've spoken, whether they're behind closed doors or to others. God knows our thoughts. Again, you see Jesus in his ministry time and time again, knowing what people are thinking without them even speaking.
We should praise God for that accountability. Yeah. That's a good thing.
Mm. Yeah. But as I look at that, I do think kind of reading the messages and what's been reported there, at one level, I'm not massively surprised by what they reveal. I am massively surprised by the way that people speak of each other and speak of others and the language that they use. And but the basic sense that here's a group of people wrestling with what is the right policy response to a pandemic that is unfolding, where the science is unclear, where there's a multiplicity of different kind of scientific opinions, where there's a multiplicity of different political sort of opinions, where kind of key political leaders are not agreed as to what approach they should take. At one level, formulating policy and deciding what to do, you are bound to have this kind of discussion. And actually, any of us involved in decision making will know that before a decision is reached and action is taken, you're going to have a discussion in which people don't necessarily have the same perspective, in which they do kind of interact with one another. So I think that the idea that there's something revealed that's kind of deeply sort of worrying about the fact that here are people kind of debating exactly what the right response is, exactly what the science means, exactly how the public will respond. A lot of this is making judgments.
Now, there's not a smoking gun in there, is
no,
there?
And I think that, I mean, sometimes government, I think, spoke publicly as though it was more certain than it was, so that they're following the science, as if that gave an objectivity. What that often meant was kind of making a risk decision on the basis of the kind of the parameters that have been presented to us by the scientists. But there's almost a desire to want to claim an objectivity to that. But judgments were made. And I think for some people, I mean, on this will open up all sorts of questions of, did churches respond in the right way to what happened during the pandemic?
Did they?
Well, I think what's really important to remember is that churches had to respond to what government said. We weren't privy to these discussions. We weren't privy to all of this information. We weren't part of the decision-making process and couldn't have been. So at one level, churches were responding to what government had in fact decided. So we were actually having to, in a sense, tell churches what the government had decided, what its implications were for churches. Within FIEC, in the main, what we tried to provide for churches was a kind of an accurate description of what the current regulatory regime was and what that would mean for local churches and their ministries, what they could do, what they couldn't do, where there was ambiguity. To some measure, we were able to lobby government for kind of as much freedom for churches as kind of possible. Now, I don't think that we were in a position to be able to, as it were, make scientific critiques of the government's position. Now, there's clearly debate about exactly what the science was, but that was developing kind of all the time. So I think it's unrealistic to say that churches and church leaders should have been able to actually judge the kind of the science and the public policy, appropriate public policy, better than the government could with all of its information there. We were largely responding to what government had decided. It's absolutely right that it's looked back on, were the right calls made? But that doesn't mean to say that churches, leaders and individuals were in a better position to make those calls at the time that they were made than the people who were best informed with all of the information.
And I think people want to put all of this in one of two categories, which is either conspiracy or it's incompetence. And actually, the answer is there are more categories than that. And I think what the text has revealed to a certain extent is it's neither conspiracy nor is it incompetence. It's just, we don't really know.
Yeah.
And this is the best guess.
And that's decision-making, isn't
it? And that's decision-making. Yeah. And that's actually leadership in the local church as well.
And I think for those who kind of objected to the way the church responded to the lockdown, it was always possible to find a scientist saying what you wanted to believe. At root, it was about some kind of deep theological convictions about the nature of the relationship between the church and the state, between a freedom and the right response to a public health situation. And at one level, those convictions, you could always find somebody who would scientifically kind of support what you wanted to do. And I think we just have to recognise that.
Well, we wait to see what the public inquiry
can comes we talk up about
with.
Something else?
Yes, you want to talk about nepotism.
I want to talk about nepo babies.
Pardon?
Well, it's one of the words of 2022.
You might think,
here we are, March, we're a bit late to it, aren't we? But it is
2023.
It was a word of 2022.
Oh, I see.
But it's rearing its head again in the news because it's the Oscars. And so in LA and in the Hollywood La La Land, suddenly there's a big furore about nepo babies. It's about nepotism. This is about whether if you are the child of a star, are you more likely to become a star yourself? You'll have a view on this, Phil. Drinking deeply in the world of
celebrity,
professional football.
Oh, I see. Okay, right. Yeah.
You know, just because your dad was a famous footballer,
he wasn't.
Does that make you, a great footballer?
Oh, I see.
Okay. Or could we say, just because your dad was a great football manager, Frank Lampard Senior, does that make you a great football manager, Frank Lampard Junior? Absolutely not, Everton. But there is this. It's interesting. A lot of stars that are gracing screen in the US, especially in Hollywood, are children of famous people. And it's always been that way. Jamie Lee Curtis is daughter of...
I don't know.
Write in and tell us. She's married a lord, by the way. Did you know that?
No.
She's actually a lady.
Okay.
Something or other. Mm. Anyway, that's by the by. So I think there's always been that kind of nepotism, sort of family connections, because actually a lot of casting is done through connection. And there are a lot of famous Hollywood film stars, Kate Hudson would be another one, who have famous parents. And so there's a question of, actually, does this marginalise people who have real talent but don't have connections? And the answer, I think, is demonstrably yes. It does marginalise them, that actually jobs in Hollywood don't just come through a fair casting process. They actually come through connections. And
not what you know, it's who you know, is the thing.
I think that's right. And I think inevitably some of that creeps into life, because actually connections do matter. Relationships do matter. I think there is a lesson there for the church. So it's interesting for the church. I think in some parts of the world, and in the UK as well, in some places, we have suffered from nepotism. You know, because your dad was a great leader, you should be in leadership too. And possibly even in church, you are raised up before your time, or a ministry is guarded for you. And I think at its worst, that's really, really dangerous and really, really unhelpful. People should be considered in their own right.
But there are good examples of where people's sons have gone on to be great ministers as well. So think of our own Johnny Prine,
Exactly.
Son of Derek Prine.
Exactly. And I think we need not to be afraid of raising up for leadership people who have well-known parents. But they do need to be considered in their own right. That's the challenge, I think. And I think one of the encouraging things in church life is we're better at this now. We're better at having open recruitment procedures, for example. Most churches do, and I think this is really healthy. They do advertise roles. And of course, you can, if you've got connections, talk to your connections. But if you've got an open advertisement policy, I think that really helps. Our jobs now internally, we advertise openly. We think that's really important. So I think there are ways to counter it, and we mustn't cut off people who are coming up. But we do need to guard against giving jobs to people just because we know them, either because we're related to them in familial terms, or actually because we have very deep personal connections with them. You know, just appointing someone to the next post because they're the anointed successor. We don't believe in apostolic succession, but actually when you look at some ministries and some churches over the years, you'd be surprised to know that. So yeah, I'm fighting against nepo babies, but I'm rejoicing actually that people who are raised by good and godly leaders often turn out to be good and godly leaders themselves.
So I think one of the challenges with nepotism, the reason why we find it offensive, is that it is where it's particularly people promoted and given positions who don't really have the ability that justifies the position that they're given. In the church, I think actually it is very rarely worked where somebody's kind of son taking over the ministry of a father has been helpful and useful to a kind of a church. Often that has not led to continued growth and success. So there's a difference between people gaining their sort of role on the basis of their merits, their gifts, their abilities, actually compared to others who could be in their role. They are the right person, and where they are appointed simply because of who they are. But it's complex because at the same time, parents do want to help their children. Parents do want to bring advantages to their children. That's why we want to kind of sort of educate them, help them, enable them to have opportunities. There is no doubt that having parents who sort of care for their children and invest in them enables them to do better in life. All the statistics are that kind of children who are brought up in kind of sort of stable marriages, in the end, just statistically, sort of do better in life than those who aren't brought up in stable marriages. That's not to say there aren't some wonderful kind of single parents who do an astonishing job of helping their children. But statistically speaking, if you are in a kind of a stable marriage, the children are likely to have greater opportunity that flows from that. Parents who are educated, who then have education for their children are more likely to have opportunities that come from that. And so I think there is a reality that the world is it's not possible to create a perfectly equal society. And biblically, that's right. As parents, we believe the Bible teaches that it is right to seek to bring up our children, to train them, to help them. And that will inevitably give them a kind of an advantage. So there's a real kind of tension there between people gaining unfair opportunity that they're not really qualified to have simply because of who they are and who their parents are. And actually, the way that we want to invest in our children, of course, in the church, we want that to be within the family of the church as well, not just our own biological children, but actually the kind of the spiritual children that we have, because we're a wider family. So we don't narrow down just on blood kind of links and family. We have a
and actually raising a leader from within the church should be the most natural place for a leader to
Absolutely.
Be raised in many ways.
Mm. Yeah.
By the way, the answer to the pop quiz is Tony Curtis.
There we are.
I mean, a good example of this, I think, is Franklin Graham. Sorry, not a good example of nepotism, but a good example of someone who is clearly gifted. Billy Graham, clearly gifted preacher. Franklin Graham, his son, clearly gifted preacher. He's been preaching in Mexico the last couple of weeks. It's remarkable fruit, a remarkable number of people are giving themselves to Christ in the same kind of vein as his father's preaching. But I'm hoping and praying and guessing that he got that role because he's a fine preacher, not because he's Billy Graham's son. That's how it should be. And actually, it's not a surprise, having sat at his father's feet, that he's a fine preacher and he's learned some of those things. We shouldn't be surprised at that.
Well, Adrian, John, thank you very much. Go well in Keswick. Go well at the Affinity Theological Studies Conference. This has been In the News, the FIUC podcast, and we'll speak to you again soon. Do rate, leave a review, share so that other people can find it. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks,
Thank
Will.
You.